This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around the community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This man grew up in Connecticut in the US and is currently based in Seattle, Washington. His career began when he was studying at the School of Art Institute of Chicago and found himself interested in performance art. As an actor, burlesque performer, and drag queen, he is best known for being a contestant on the sixth season of RuPaul's Drag Race, and most recently, the third season of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars. On All-Stars, he chose to eliminate himself, a move that critics call one of the most controversial and unthinkable moments in the show's history. He currently teaches at the Seattle Academy of Burlesque and runs a theatrical production company, De La Rue Presents. He is also touring the world with his solo show, Inferno A Go-Go, coming to Australia in September. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Ben, otherwise known as Ben de la Creme, to Word for Word.
I definitely had a difficult time as a kid in school. I was very, very weird, very, very gay. I refer to her as terminally delightful. And this never was a call out for attention. It was just that I hadn't found people like me.
If this show had been on television, it would have changed my life.
You gave us some fantastic looks. You delivered glamour, you delivered camp, you delivered fun.
God, I know I'm not supposed to talk about any of this, but whatever. Just fully incapable of blending as a young person.
I am so, so grateful for my time here, both on the last season and this season.
You really want to be a star?
Yeah, I do.
Ben de la Creme, I know this didn't turn out the way you had planned, but I hope it makes you an even fiercer queen, because your time here is not over.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's quite exciting to have you here.
I'm excited as well. This is mutual excitement.
How have you been going with the Australian accent so far?
Oh, it's nothing. Australian accents are lovely and lilting. I spent time in Scotland recently, so I can handle any kind of crazy accent.
Is this the first time you've been here in Australia?
No, I was here once, but it was like 4 years ago. I did a tour here with Detox from RuPaul's Drag Race, which was super fun, but I was very new to touring, so the whole thing is kind of a blur. So the last time I was sort of even in the region was I did the World Buskers Festival in New Zealand, which was super fun. But I know that's a different place, so don't get offended.
Neighbors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At best.
I mean, if you're going to fly all the way around the world to go to, like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like I can lump them together in that regard, but I'm not, you know, I'm not saying y'all are the same thing.
Is it possible that you've been out-talked on your two-time appearance of RuPaul's Drag Race?
Oh, no, I can talk about myself forever.
Well, we're going to get into that in a little bit. But okay. First of all, I want to say you grew up in Connecticut.
I did.
What was your childhood like?
Well, it was, you know, it was a mixed bag, as many life experiences are. But yeah, I grew up in very rural Connecticut. So we kind of lived in like this old farmhouse in the middle of the woods. Our closest neighbor was like miles away. I went to a small school. It was fairly conservative. I definitely had a difficult time as a kid in school. I was very, very weird, very, very gay, and just fully incapable of blending as a young person. I was one of those kids who it was like no matter how much dyeing my hair blue and wearing like insane clothes got me beat up, I couldn't not do it because it was just too much who I was. So that was wackadoo, but luckily a very supportive family. my mom was always super supportive of who I am. And my mother was an artist. My father was an actor.
So you were born into it.
Yeah. You know, I certainly grew up with people who really nurtured creativity. And a lot of actually my artistic references really come from that. I mean, like so much of, I feel like my drag is very rooted in old MGM films and like mid-century stuff, which is what my dad loves. He loves like old movie musicals, and he's like an older straight man who listens to Barbra Streisand. And then on the other side, my mom illustrated children's books. And so very much that love of kind of this sort of cartoony, over the top, brightly colored thing, I think comes from her. So yeah, I mean, my home life, my family life was really lovely, but outside of that was much rockier. So as a result, I tended to become pretty reclusive and spent a lot of time by myself. And when you're a young creative kid, there, you really get to hone your skill early on.
What was your relationship like then with these parents? I mean, these creative people. Was that a strong relationship even throughout your awkward teenage years?
Well, you know, my relationship with my mother was always super strong. She passed away when I was 13. And that, of course, is always a really rough thing to go through.
And at such a young age.
Yeah, you know, and it was a time also, of course, as I said, when I was pretty isolated from my peers as well. So it was a really lonely time, and that was really rocky. I was also starting to understand my sexuality at that age. I came out at 13, mostly because I had no choice. It was less I'm gay and more like you're gay, and me saying, oh, well, okay.
My mom used to say, sending me off to school because I was so gay and I was so loud and I refused not to be loud. And she said, just be quiet.
Right.
But I just kept bringing the attention back to me.
Yeah, you know, I always struggled with that kind of narrative, because when I was young, the thing I got a lot from adults in the community was, why are you seeking this negative attention? Why are you drawing? And I was like, why are you trying to be different from everyone else? Was a lot of that small town narrative, as if it was this cry for attention. And I was like, the attention I'm getting is not of interest to me. But I sort of, I think, thought to myself, oh, is that true? Is that what I'm doing? And then later, when I found a community of people who were more like-minded, I realized, oh, now I feel normal and integrated. And this never was a call out for attention. It was just that I hadn't found people like me.
I think in some way, especially when talking about you, it was always going to be like this.
You know, it never stopped me from being the person I was, but it certainly burdened me with a lot of shame for a really long time, and a lot of sadness and self-doubt, a certain amount of self-hatred. And I think that's a pretty common queer experience.
Sadly.
Yeah. But it never stopped me from being the person I was. And it was a long, hard journey to shake a lot of that negative internal monologue. And, you know, I don't know if anybody ever fully shakes it after going through that, but I think you can use it to fuel you in a lot of ways.
What about siblings? How many siblings did you have?
None.
Not one.
Just me in a farmhouse with my dad.
Oh my gosh, yeah. That's so full on.
It was pretty intense.
What was that relationship like moving forward from 13?
It was very strained. My dad is a wonderful man and was supportive of me as a kid, but also didn't understand me. And I don't think he knew how to be a father to a super queer son. And my mom, I think, was sort of our connector before she passed away. And after she was gone, it was like we kind of had to figure out how to have our own relationship. And there was definitely a time where I think he was trying to push me towards sports and push me towards certain more masculine traits. But I think that was really more of him not knowing what else to do and being concerned for me. But, you know, as I got a little older, and I couldn't quite see it then because I was like this angry kid, you know, I had a lot of just anger toward the world around me. But in retrospect, I look at, you know, once I got to be like 15, 16, my dad figured out that I just needed to meet other people like me. There was an annual conference for young queer kids that happened like an hour away from where we were. And my dad would like drive me there. And like, I mean, he really looked for these resources for me. And I'm very, very lucky to have had that.
It's so powerful to think that your dad could reconcile his own differences. I think a lot of parents in some way have their ideals on what their children are going to be like, which means that sometimes they think there's a bit of a grieving process, letting their kids go and from what they thought they were going to be like and then embracing them. And I think for men of that time, that's a huge obstacle to get over, as well as the fact that your relationship with him was laced with grief.
Yeah.
Like the fact that you're sitting here and being this person that you are today, I'm like, that's amazing.
I think that something that I learned from him is that you don't have to have... It's like he hadn't reconciled it. He didn't understand it yet, but he went through the actions that he knew were right. He didn't wait until he had emotionally fully gotten there. And I think that that's something that I really value and strive for, is to make the right decision and to act in a way that best exemplifies who I want to be in the world, even when I'm not. It's a little fake it till you make it, you know?
But then I think it's also when you see struggle, take the higher ground. And I think that's something that we've seen in your performance art as well. I think it's a positive message to send out into a community that is watching you.
Well, you know, I think those of us in the public eye have a responsibility to exemplify a certain kind of behavior. I think especially culturally now, there's a sort of idea, there's a narrative that being like real and truthful is saying everything that comes through your head at all times. Mm. And I think that's a little bit of a social media thing that we just think everything that we think is worth putting into the world. And I don't think it's a bad thing to self-edit in order to make sure the energy you're putting out is positive and represents something better that we can strive for.
Like, how did you overcome that at that age? So sort of people were treating you differently and you were struggling, but at the same time, to me, you are a strong person. Where does that strength come from?
Man, I don't know. I think just getting through it, you know, I mean, a lot of it was just clenching my teeth and white knuckling it and with the hope that there might be something better. And there, fortunately, I heard the message just barely enough that there might be something better in the future for me. But certainly I was a kid who wanted to opt out many times, you know. I certainly went through lots and lots of moments throughout my adolescence and teenage years where I was not convinced that life was worth living. And you just decide to do it anyway. And honestly, that's where that strength comes, is I think for me, it's like after the fact being like, I made it through that, which makes you stronger for the next time and stronger for the next time. And now you still go through all sorts of hard moments, but I have taught myself that I can come through on the other end.
How old were you when you realized that you were gay?
11. That was the first time I recognized that I was, the way I was drawn to another boy was romantic. And actually looking back, I can see all the crushes I had before that I never identified as crushes. I mean, I remember being like 7 and having a crush on my grandmother's neighbor, and just, you know, who was like 11 and seemed like old and worldly.
at 11, just looking up to my elders. Uh-huh. I think that's hilarious that, because I didn't work out my sexuality until a lot later. Mm-hmm. But then I could go back all the way through to primary school and be like, yeah, I kind of wanted to play mothers and fathers, where I was in this mother role.
Yeah.
And when you're younger, you don't really know these gender assigned roles as clearly as we end up finding them to be. So it's interesting to think that kids, when they're first born, you know, they just want to be.
Yeah.
So what would you say, though, is your first impression of gay people? Like, not your first gay experience, but like, when did you know there was gay people?
Oh, gosh. What a good question. I'm not sure that I remember. My understanding of there being other gay people was very limited. And, you know, I mean, when I was coming into my own, the internet was not a thing we had at my house. You know, I later became aware that there was like an out magazine somewhere that I'd never seen, you know. So, God, I wonder what my first exposure was. I'm not really sure. I mean, I remember being pretty young and being in like a local production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and a lot of people in the cast were at the, you know, when I think about them, I'm like, they were 30, but they were probably, you know, 16. And one of the women who played Lucy actually came out to me at like the wrap party. You know, we had like a little cast party at the end. And I just remember my mind being totally blown. And the way she said it to me was, and I'd never heard this kind of phrasing before, but the way she said it to me was, "We're family." And I had never heard, you know, queer family referred to that way before. And it like blew my mind. And I'd, you know, I'd been working with her for however long that kind of production begins, and it never occurred to me. But that was, you know, that's one that really like stuck in my mind.
Was there relief for you at that time that there was other people out there?
Yeah. I mean, I think this idea of chosen family is, has become so important in my life, you know, and it's one of those families that you can add to constantly. And so I actually have this giant extended chosen family now. And there is, I mean, there's so much relief in that. There's, you know, so many of us have strained home lives and complicated relationships to the idea of family or home. And, you know, and something that's been really nice is actually as my relationship to my father has improved and deepened and he's gotten more comfortable with the fact that I'm a drag performer and all of that, I've sort of realized that I've had the opportunity to invite him into my chosen family in this way where it's like, yeah, you were born my family, but I also can choose you. Mm. And that's a powerful thing as well.
Isn't that beautiful when we reconnect because we choose to with our parents?
Yeah.
We don't see that happening in our teenage years, but mm-hmm. I feel like that with my mom. Like, I think I have a friendship.
Yeah.
What was your first relationship then? Like, what was the first, did you have a first kiss with a man?
Oh God, what was my first? Oh my God, my first kiss was horrific. There's so many like weird, it's hard to oversimplify my like my adolescence because there were so many bizarre elements. But one place that I found like a little bit more of a liberal bubble was that I started going to a Unitarian Universalist youth group when I was like 15, which is, I mean, if you're not familiar with it, it's a religion, but it's very vague in its belief system. Like there's Buddhists and Christians Jewish people within it. But, you know, it's very much around liberal values. There's this big conference that happens annually of Unitarian youths kind of getting together and doing workshops or whatever. So I went to this conference and there was a game of Spin the Bottle, and it was the first non like gender separated game of, I mean, this was like after hours, you know, Unitarian Universalist youth after hours. So my first kiss was actually with a guy during that game of Spin the Bottle who I just like thought was so incredibly hot. Again, seemed older and wiser, probably 1 year older than me. And it was one of those horrific, hard tongue, stabby kisses. Oh. And I was like, is this what I've been waiting for? Is this what it is? Oh, Lord. I was so disappointed. But it turns out it gets better than that.
How old were you when you had your first relationship then?
I actually had my first boyfriend when I was 17. And that was looked the way a relationship when you're 17 might look. So it was pretty limited in its depth. But, you know, he was a sweet guy and, you know, relationships are for learning.
Do you know what's weird about, because we're about the same age, there wasn't as many gay role models for us growing up. So who were your role models? Like for me, I had Madonna's Like a Prayer album and I was like obsessed, but I'd wait for my mum and my brother to leave the house and I would dance around the lounge room with just a shirt and my knickers on. Not a good look, let me tell you. Who were these role models for you?
Yeah. Well, in terms of in that way, like people I was super drawn to. I mean, when I was younger, it was all like old MGM musical, like Ann Miller, you know, I was obsessed with. And actually, in retrospect, Bendel Krim looks a lot like Ann Miller in terms of her styling. Certainly not her tap dancing prowess. But then I would say that Who Framed Roger Rabbit was like a revelation to me when Jessica Rabbit first stepped out on that stage. It was, I used to wear the, you know, this was in the 90s when those really giant oversized t-shirts were in vogue. And so I would take the neck of my t-shirt and I would stretch it down and put my arms through it. So it was like a strapless dress. And I would do this at school when the teacher would like step out. I mean, this is the kind of kid I was. You know what I mean?
Can you give me a little bit of the song? Come on.
You had plenty money, 1922. Boom. Yes. Yeah. Oh, I tried to do the bass line and I got lost. But that's actually, it was originally a Peggy Lee song. I mean, this is the kind of kid I was too, is that my dad listened to Peggy Lee. So like Fever and like the original version of that song were like what I grew up on. So.
It's like you're well adversed to all of these cultural people. I'm starting to work out why you were so good on this RuPaul's Drag Race is because your back catalog is so extensive.
But I have zero references of current culture. Like I am, all these queens that I'm on tour with right now are talking about, I'm like, I don't know the pop stars or the albums or the tours that you're talking about at all. Do you guys want to talk about Brigitte Bardot?
What's the sound that you get on RuPaul's Drag Race thing? Like it goes silent? It's like that. What, I can't think.
Oh, yeah, that little like rattling.
Yeah,
sound,
exactly. Yeah. When you say something, because that looks like you're like, Brigitte Bardot, everyone. And they're
yeah, and I just sit there and it rattles. And then I like suck on my straw of my empty drink.
You've been described as being terminally delightful, which I love. Did you acquire that name for yourself?
Yeah, so Terminally Delightful was a word combination that was bestowed upon me in just. And I think part of me being drawn to that is that, you know, my character is really positive and effervescent and likes to look at the bright side. But I also kind of think of that as a little bit of a critique of that idea. I mean, the idea that delightfulness can be terminal, right? It's actually to be just positive without analysis is actually not a great quality. And so I think of this character as actually almost because I mean, when if you ever see one of my shows that I do with her, she's constantly trying to look at the bright side of things and being confronted with realities that she then has to figure out how to navigate. And so I think of it as a tool. So that's kind of where that came from.
Is it a coping mechanism for who you are? Where does this mantra of looking for positivity till death come from?
Well, it's a million different pieces. You know what I mean? Like I've been doing this so long that there's a lot of different pieces to that puzzle. But when I was living in Chicago and I started doing drag out in the clubs, my character's name was Tina Angst. And she was riot girl, punk rock, like angry. Like I was always doing La Tigra and Bikini Kill and that kind of music. And it was so much a manifestation of this kind of outpouring of anger and resistance that I think was left over from those really difficult teen years, you know? And I think there was a lot of value in that. You know, I got really into, I found like an amazing group of queer women who I started really having like a larger understanding of queer culture when I lived in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And a different kind of grasp of feminism and stuff like that. And there was, and that Riot Girl movement was really inspiring and exciting to me. But then personally, I started seeing more and more queens. There was this queen in Chicago named Miss Fousey, who was like this older queen who wore this like wig hat made out of ostrich feathers, and she would just go around to the bars and she would call everyone pineapple and she would hand out candy, and she was so sweet, and she was like this mother to the community. And I started to be like, what is this anger doing for me? How is this making me less angry, you know? And there was this way in which she was like, she was portraying this generosity that sort of uplifted everyone and made you sort of feel there was something better. And so I guess I started to think about adopting that more. So that's kind of where the first piece of like, oh, I'm more interested in pushing into striving for positivity, even when you don't feel like it.
Am I wrong by saying this, but you're the first person from RuPaul's Drag Race that I've interviewed that I get the sense that you could almost create another character like Ben de la Creme isn't just the only character that you are going to create.
Like, yeah.
Most of the time when I've interviewed RuPaul's Drag Race people, I feel like it's just Courtney act. There's never going to be anything. And the tie between Shane and Courtney is so close that there's a real lack of divide. Talking to you today, I get the feeling that you could make a shift and create a sister for Ben de la Creme in a way.
Well, actually, the show that I'm touring right now, I'm play seven different characters in. You know, I actually, like, I love that very much. And I do consider that it's definitely a skill that I've cultivated, and it's something that I like doing. All Stars was really fun because I had the opportunity to do that. Because while impersonations have never been my passion, I really like creating and embodying characters.
The best thing about it is that I kind of feel like you have a good sense of self away from your performance art, where I think sometimes people can get consumed by watching themselves and what that performance turned out to be, and then they can't draw the line between what they are edited as on a show, what that person is versus who you are sitting in front of me right now.
Yeah.
Like, I get a complete sense of you're in control, you are Ben, and Ben de la Creme is performance art.
Yeah. Very much.
Is that how you feel?
That's very much how I think about it. I kind of resisted Drag Race for a while before I went on season six. And one of the big reasons was I had always admired these queens like Varla Jean Merman, Coco Peru, Dina Martina, these queens who have, you don't get to see them outside of drag. You don't know who they are. And when Drag Race started, I was like, I don't want to see this. I don't want to go to Disneyland and watch Minnie Mouse take her head off. Like, I don't want that illusion spoiled. You know what I mean? Mm. And there's something about, if you don't know who the person behind the character is, this character can contain this magic that's better than real life. So that was already something that I was very, that separation of myself and the character was really important to me before Drag Race. And it's been a useful tool to stay sane after Drag Race.
What was your first performance as a drag queen?
My first performance was probably my junior year of high school. I forced two other boys to get in a drag with me and perform Gotta Have a Gimmick. And I actually have to say that even looking back at those pictures, I looked pretty good. Like, but I also had been obsessed with drag, and I mean, I didn't have a word for it. I didn't have the language, but I'd been obsessed with like makeup and whatever. I mean, when I was very young, I used to steal makeup from the drugstore. I would take it home to my rambling farmhouse in the woods. I would lock myself in the bathroom. I would put on a full face, and then I would wash it all off and leave the bathroom. And that was something that I did on the regular as a kid. So by the time I first actually set foot outside in public, I had a few years of practice. So it looks pretty good, you know?
Was there a moment that you realized that you could go mainstream and make money out of drag? Was there a light bulb moment where you're like...
It was slow. It was a little bit different. So I moved to Boston for 1 year after high school before I went to Chicago for school. And when I was living there, I went to see Varla Jean Merman for the first time, who's like my biggest drag inspiration. She was performing in like the basement of a church or something, and it was for like probably 30 people. And what she was doing was so mind-blowing to me. It was this full theatrical performance, and I was like, oh, there's a container here for like, this person is making a living at this. So it wasn't really like, oh, I'm going to go mainstream, oh, I'm going to be a millionaire, but it was like, okay, there's a path for me. There's a job. It's called drag queen, and I can do it.
What advice would you give Ben at the age of 12 if he was to walk in right now?
Oh man, you know, I actually think about this constantly. It's not advice, but I think constantly about if I could go back to 12-year-old me and I could say, hey, let me tell you what's going to happen. And the way I never could have imagined this life for myself, but I think in some way always did. And I just, it's a weird practice, but I think, you know, one thing that I encourage people to do is like dream really big about what the future could be. And then imagine that future you tells you it happens. You know, it's like, then it's just a path you follow, you know?
Life isn't going to be good. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
So then all this excess stress and worry is only going to hold you back. Imagine going back and telling that 12-year-old Ben
what's going to happen, and then think about how much better it could have been.
And it actually, I mean, people ask me what my pre-show practices, like, you know, some people like do breathing exercises or meditation. I look in the mirror and I like, it's actually kind of uncomfortable, but I like make sure to stare into my own eyes and say, like, imagine how you would have felt if
can
you could
see
have
that young version of yourself in your face when you do that.
Oh my god, it's a really intense but incredible thing to be able to think about. I had this incredible experience at DragCon in LA this last year, which was, so you're in this booth, and I specifically actually had mine sort of like curtained off because I wanted it to be this like intimate little experience. So people would like come in, and then that was the first time, and we would like have a little moment that was private. This kid and his mom walked in, and my boyfriend was actually, he was working the booth with me. He was doing the photos. And it was like the kid walked in and like it was like the wind was knocked out of me. And my boyfriend like looked at him and looked at me and was like, just his eyes said, holy shit, this kid was the spitting image of me at that age. And like I tear up just thinking about it. It was this... And, you know, he was there with his mom who had, like, brought him to DragCon to, like, meet a queen who he admired. And it was, like, it was this crazy, trippy time warp where I was, like, this is that opportunity. And after he left, I was, like, you guys have to hold the line. And I just, like, wept. It was so... But it was beautiful. It was amazing. It was super powerful, you know. And like, you know, the reality is like I just met some kid who looks kind of like how I look. But it is deeper than that, because it reminds you that those connections, they are real and they are important to those people. And it was just, I mean, but it was this, I don't know. I get a little woo woo and I get a little, you know, I don't necessarily believe that things happen for a reason, but I believe that you can find reason in things that happen. And that one was, it was just a beautiful experience to get to have. It felt very, it was something I didn't know I wanted or needed, but it was pretty beautiful.
I think sometimes the universe has a way of giving you something that you need.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of those examples. And not everyone gets to live that life and have those moments come to us. But if you are someone that's been lucky enough to have those moments, wow. Does everything feel more purposeful?
Yeah.
And you go, this is what I'm doing here. Yeah. This is why I do this podcast. I was originally asked to do it. And I was like, oh, I don't know. And it was someone else's job before mine. I was like, I don't want to do someone else's job. And then I thought about it. And I was like, think of all the LGBTI people around the world that is going to listen to this chat. We're going to unearth stories about real people. And they're not going to feel so alone. And that is opening up a pathway and a doorway for so many people to have that moment that you just had.
Yeah.
I'm like an emotional person, so I just like slap myself around.
Oh my god, me too. I love feeling emotions.
So do I, but I have to be really careful because like some of these word for words, I'm crying. I bleed for people.
Yeah.
If you tell me your story, I'm there with you, yeah. You know, and I shouldn't do that as the interviewer. I should be like, let's keep going.
Well, both, you know, I mean, like I think there's a way in which that kind of connectivity is undervalued, and it's nice to, I mean, certainly just sitting here with you, I'm like, okay, how often do you get to sit down with somebody new and have a sense of intimacy? It's
and vibe, you know,
yeah,
and share.
And I think, you know, this is something I hear actually, I've been seeing like this post shared a lot and stuff that I think is, you know, why do we hoard intimacy? You know, why do we decide that intimate moments have to be reserved for like our partners or whatever? I mean, you know, why cultivate scarcity? Intimacy is so important to us as animals. And it's like, we have built such shells, and I mean especially queer people, we have these huge protective, we have armor. We have to.
We've learned to do that.
Yeah.
When did you first come across RuPaul's Drag Race? Did you start watching that right at the very first season?
I mean, I was aware of it before it began. I remember seeing, I think somebody like sent me on MySpace or something, the casting call when it first, before season one. And I actually remember a couple friends of mine from Chicago were auditioning, and that's kind of how I became aware of it. And then I didn't think it was for me, really, even as a viewer, because it seemed so, like, about modeling and fashion, which was just not really my interest. I really got into it on season four. I think Sharon Needles was so much of a breakthrough for that show, because a lot of the people who were, like, a little bit into, like, the weirder elements of drag, just seeing her image was like, oh, something else is happening with this show. What is this? And so I tuned in for Sharon, but then, of course, fell in love with, you know, Latrice. And I mean, that cast of that show was just every archetype you needed. It was so fully fleshed out. And then, of course, I went back and watched all the rest of it. And then, you know, the following season, one of my best friends went on it and won. So I very quickly went from not actually watching Drag Race to being fully submerged into it. And other people had been like, oh, you should audition. And I was like, I don't think, it's like, I don't relate to it. But then basically Jinx won and I was like, oh, crap. Well, now I have to do it because I'm not just going to live in her shadow for the rest of my life.
Hell no.
Because before that, she was like a baby drag queen in Seattle, and I'd been casting her in my shows, you know, like.
Anything you can do, I can do better. What makes a good drag queen?
I think digging something up that's genuine and inside of you. I think the thing that I see a lot of young drag queens doing is reflecting everything they're seeing around them and watching too many YouTube tutorials and doing the makeup that they see the girls on Drag Race wearing. And I think the queens who, certainly the Drag Race queens who on me make the biggest impact are, you know, like the weirdos like Alaska and like, you know, Alyssa Edwards and like these people who are really like, that's a true reflection of something in them that's really heightened. And I, you know, people are like, oh, what would you tell like a drag queen who's just starting out? And I'm like, tune out a lot of the rest and like go inside and what's there.
Be original and be authentic, I think.
Yes.
You know, that's where you're going to carve something different. Yes, you may copy someone and your copying ability may be outstanding, but you're never going to cross the finish line if all you're doing is mimicking someone else.
And certainly, you know, draw inspiration. I mean, you have to develop that and mesh it with what's inside you. And it's like, yes, it is about authenticity, but also within that, kind of understanding the way that artifice can reveal things. You know what I mean? Like, you don't... You can still deal with artifice. You can still... But that can reveal something real and true.
But I need to ask you more RuPaul's Drag Race questions. Okay. I'm like, I could sit here and talk like this with you forever.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Anyway, so did you apply and get into RuPaul's straight away?
Yes.
Is that because Jinx helped you out?
No.
Come on. Did you not call in a favor?
No, I mean...
How many times did you name drop Jinx while you're in your audition?
She made a cameo in my audition. Like, I definitely did, like, you know, because we were working the same gigs, you know, so, you know, so I, in a dressing room, had her, like, give me her seal of approval. But yeah, I made a really...
Tell me what you were going to
really
say.
Really good audition tape. I will. I'll tell you what I was going to say. I really worked hard on my audition tape. I mean, I think you can kind of tell this on the show, but I tend to like really go all in. Like, it's like, for me, it's like pretty all or nothing. Like, I am like going to go hold hog and like make bold choices and like really go fully into it. Or I'm just going to be lazy and not do anything, which is also a thing I do. But I was, you know, I hadn't wanted to audition and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to put every resource I have into doing this. And I put together an audition tape that really, I mean, I'd been doing drag for a decade at that point. I had a lot of material to draw from. But the thing I was going to say, then I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. But then it's like, I don't know, what are they going to do? Kick me off Drag Race? Is that I heard through the grapevine that there was someone who was auditioning for season 7, who a friend of mine was trying to get on season 7, and they had contacts at World of Wonder, and so they were like, okay, do you have any tips for how to like make a good audition tape? And the person at World of Wonder said, okay, don't tell anybody I did this, but this is like one of the best audition tapes we've ever seen. And they sent them mine.
That's amazing.
They told me that and I was like, ah! But it was weird because like after I sent in my tape, like all the other girls I knew who had auditioned, they were like getting, you know, and Jinx had had this too, where it was like, you get like, okay, here's, now we want this from you. Now we want this. Now here's like some questions. Now fill out this form. Now whatever. I didn't get any of that. It was radio silence after I sent in my video until the very end. And they just told me I was in the cast, which means I got cast like right away. Right?
Nailed it.
I know. I was really excited about it.
Did you have any preconceived ideas on what RuPaul was going to be like going in?
So the actual experience of Drag Race, definitely I had a leg up by being so close with Jinx. You know, she told me a lot about what it was like to be there. So I knew that interaction with Ru would be limited. You know, certainly, I think now at the time it's pretty common knowledge that what happens on camera is about the extent of your interaction with Ru. But I think a lot of the girls at the time were like, oh, we're just going to like pal around on set. And it is absolutely not like that. So
are you shocked, though? Because I'm shocked. Like, RuPaul gives me the impression on that show that once you get on, your family, and that you probably get to go over to his ranch, and like he will always look after you. Where
it really,
really shocked me. I know, but I'm so naive when I say this. But like Courtney was the first one. Courtney Shane was the first one to say that to me. Was like, I was really let down. All you see with that interaction on the show is all you get.
Yeah,
and he expected more. Didn't you expect more?
I didn't. I don't know why I didn't. I wasn't upset by not getting more.
I'd clap back at that. I'd be like, sorry, hello, I'm here, I've made it, this is huge for me. And like RuPaul, I just want to, at some point, the payback for me doing the work that I'm doing on this show means that I just want to have a moment with you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, RuPaul is and always has been a very publicly constructed specific product, and I don't say that in any kind of negative way, but if you look at RuPaul from, you know, her beginnings in the 90s when Supermodel was released, I mean, it's always been this shiny packaged thing. I never felt like I wasn't surprised by the fact that RuPaul is actually a private person who has like created a product, and the product is for the public, and she's not, you know, like he's, I don't know. It didn't surprise me.
If you could summarize season six and what that experience was like for you, how do you do that?
It was like rodent caught in one of those have a heart traps where they're just like running around in circles, and you can tell that, and you can see their heart beating out of their chest. I mean, I was just in fight or flight mode that entire time. I was so terrified. Mm. I was so anxious. You know, and maybe that's another reason I wasn't actually disappointed by my Ru experience. I didn't have the mental capacity to process that. I was just trying to figure out how I was going to live another day, you know? Mm. So, yeah, the whole thing was just so overwhelming. I mean, it's very weird to be there. Nothing about it looks... I mean, the way it reads on television is very different from being present in that space. Yeah, the whole thing was kind of a blur. I mean, afterwards... In a way that it didn't seem to, I was surprised that it didn't seem to be that same way for other queens. Like, I literally could not tell you the name of anyone who worked on set or recognize their faces. And people from production would walk up to me, like, in some other context and be like, oh, hey. And I'd be like, I mean, I couldn't even see past whatever project I was focused on, you know? And which was interesting because the second time going back, it was so different. I mean, I really was just, oh, we're just a bunch of people in a room. Like, me and RuPaul are just human beings having a conversation right now, except, like, you're in a wig behind a desk and I'm in a wig on a runway.
As a viewer, I saw that, though, in you. Because I watched these seasons and I just got a completely different portrait painted for me.
Yeah.
And I think that if someone asked me to fill out why, what you just described is what it is. Yeah. And that is that you were a deer in a headlight for one whole season. Uh-huh. And then when you came back, you went, oh, I took notes. And now I'm back and I'm just going to be myself.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take the time to say hello to people.
Yeah.
Because I'm relaxed.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really, you know, I'd also said no a couple of times. I didn't think I wanted to do All Stars. And so by the time I actually got there, I was kind of like, I had a lot less power, you know? Mm. Like the power dynamic had really shifted. I was like, oh, you guys need me too, you know? It's like we're all just different departments at the same job. I mean, if you'd told me, you know, even 6 months before I said yes to it that I was going to do All Stars, I would have laughed in your face.
Why would you turn down this experience to come back and use what you've learned?
Well, I felt really gross, actually, after season six. I felt, it just felt icky, for lack of a better word. I didn't know what it was going to feel like to be produced, and I felt a little used. I felt a little dirty. And it was like, after the fact, I could really see the way... God, I know I'm not supposed to talk about any of this, but whatever. It's like, I couldn't see what was happening when I was inside of it. And then when watching it, I was like, oh, I was like not letting down my barriers enough. So there was a circumstance created where I would like fully just kind of have an emotional breakdown when I was almost sent home. And then I was kept. And I was like, and none of it was necessarily like impacted me negatively, but I just was able to see the ways in which I was manipulated, and that didn't feel good to me. And so that was, you know, I just didn't want to subject myself to that again. You know, I mean, part of what I love about drag is that I get to construct every aspect of it. I'm in complete control of everything that happens on stage. So to give up that control is really intense when you're the kind of performer I am. And then, you know, at the same time, Drag Race is, right, like some people think of it as an end game. I've always thought of it as a stepping stone, right? So I went on season six. It really elevated what I was able to do after that. I was still doing exactly what I was doing before, but on a much higher scale. I was able to sell way more tickets. And I was actually very content with what everything looked like. You know, when they approached me for All Stars, I was like, I'm pretty happy. Like, I don't need to get back into the crazy tour schedule. You know, I'm booked throughout the year. I'm doing my theater stuff. I don't really have to do all the like crazy nightclubs and be on an airplane every day. And that's kind of, I mean, that's still what I want my life to look like in 10 years, you know? So, but then I was like, you know, there's no retirement plan and my hips are about to give out. So I better...
Got to go back and do a RuPaul's Drag Race. You kept nailing it, though, right from the start. Did you think that you were going to do as well? I felt like you knew that it was going to be gold.
Lord, no.
I've got a friend of mine. She's she was like, are you gonna watch All Stars? Ben De La Creme's going to be on. And she was like, and I've got Ben De La Creme, and he's going to nail it. And I was like, yeah, I kind of remembered what happened the last time, and I just didn't see that. And then over the first episode of All Stars, I was like, oh, you've won. Like, I felt like, and then every week that you were there, I felt like that maybe you'd made a pact with, I don't care where it goes, but it just felt like you just kept nailing it again and again and again, and that you knew you would, or no?
Well, I was super surprised, but I think a lot of it, I think my success did come out of this sort of, you know, just a little bit being like, this is not going to make or break me. Like, Drag Race isn't the beginning, you know, it's not the be all end all of drag. It's like, you know, you go there and you do what you can do, but you're not in control of a lot of things. And I think just kind of, you know, being a little more relaxed in that way actually allowed me to do closer to what I do in the real world. And you know, and then there was other thing where, I mean, like, as I said before, I had a pretty strong sense of mistrust, you know, so I was like, oh, they could just, you know, decide at any moment that, like, I don't belong here, you know? That also, like, maybe a little fire under me as well. I was like, they could try to get rid of me at any time.
And then you Seinfeld yourself, which is what I call it. Why did you do it?
I mean, a lot of reasons. I mean, one thing is, I mean, I think what you just said about Seinfeld is actually very accurate. I mean, you know, part of me is like, okay, I've been doing so well in this competition. This is boring. Like, no producer is going to think this makes good TV. So what's going to happen in the next two episodes? You know, there was definitely an element of like, y'all aren't just going to let me coast to the top and then get the crown. Like, that is dull, you know? So there was like, that was definitely like somewhere in my brain. But also it was this thing where, I mean, I would say the bigger piece of it was that they asked me, I said no. They asked me, I said no. And a big reason for that as well was that when All Stars 2 came on, I was furious with it. I was so angry with the format they'd created. I thought it was really crappy to, like, make the girls eliminate each other. I was like, how is this relevant to sharing these skills? Like, I understand why it's a competition. Like, for whatever reason, audiences need that element in order to frame it. But this show is not about... To me, that's not the heart of the show. The heart of the show is artists showing off their skill sets. And so I was like, I stopped, like, I watched two episodes, a door left. I was like, I get why you're leaving. And I stopped watching.
I think that from my perspective, I felt like that whoever sets the rules for that show, whoever's writing that series, I felt like they conjured a reason for the girls to compete harder. That rule that came in for the girls to eliminate themselves was only there to turn you guys against each other.
Yes.
Harder.
Yes.
And to add some drama to the show. However, that's being nasty for the sake of being nasty. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, to me, about drag, and sort of the way I think about drag is about creating, you know, community and something beautiful. Like, it's about creating art, and it comes from all these people who have been separated, you know, from their communities, people who have been, you know, told their... Of course there's, like, sadness and bitterness and anger amongst drag queens. That's something that comes from all of our history as being, like, young queer people who are socialized in a world that says we suck, you know? Mm-hmm. So, of course, that's inside of us, and we figured out how to navigate it and how to be better than that in the outside world. And then we're put in a situation where they're like, let's dredge up these old feelings and use them to turn again. Like, I think that's messed up. Like, I do drag in order to bond and, like, have a sense of family, like we were talking about. Anyway.
Which I think is the reason why you did what you did. I mean, that's where the answer comes from, because right. I think you go, well, I'm gonna do this because I'm gonna set a higher benchmark for all of you. You know, I'm gonna prove to you all that it's important to look outside your own competitiveness, to look outside your own hatred, and to take, what is it that Michelle Obama says?
When they go low, we go high. Yeah.
You know, and I felt like that is really what you did. Did the other girls appreciate it? Because they were so thirsty at that point that I just was like, I don't know if they appreciated it enough. Like, I saw them crying and they were like, I can't believe she's pulling herself out of the competition. But at the same time, I could see this look on all three of their faces being like, thank Christ, because she was going to win.
Yeah. Well, Kennedy wrote me, like, a really beautiful note, actually. She was like, that was so selfless. And the reality is that, like, it wasn't about being selfless, but it was about, I think it was about sending a message, and it was about setting an example, you know, because one of the reasons I didn't want to do Drag Race was, you know, like, I didn't agree with that element of it. I felt like I was in this catch 22 where I was like, if I say no to this, I'm going to regret not having done it. And if I say yes to this, I'm going to feel like I'm selling out. And in that moment, I was like, holy crap, I did so well at this. I never could have done it if I hadn't had the track record I had. I was like, oh, I got to have this aspect of the experience. And now I don't have to be losing this part of myself. I don't have to feel like I'm betraying something about myself. I can be like, I was given a rare opportunity to have both.
I felt like you took control. Like, you were able to go,
yes,
I can control this.
Yep.
So that is why I'm doing it. The last thing I'm going to say about this is that I felt like the producers and RuPaul should have not taken your exit from the competition. I felt like the next episode, I really felt you should have been there. I felt like they should have said, you can't pull yourself out of the competition.
Well, not me. I mean, like... Well, I was so mad when they made me come back for the last show. I mean, I was furious. I was like, I walked out of here, like, I'm done. And then I had to sit in a hotel room for 5 days and then come back and, like do exactly the thing that was the reason I left. And I refused. I was like, I am not doing this. And then, you know, at some point they just wear you down and you're like, oh my God, I can't fight with producers anymore.
Can you answer a question from my friend Ed Pitts? He said to me, the reason why you left that season was that you were so good on that show that they needed to bring you back for All Stars season 4.
Oh my God.
That was the only reason why you left. And I'm like, don't worry about it. Because I was in Sydney for Mardi Gras at the time. Don't worry about it, Ben. It's because Ben De La Creme's coming back for season 4, All Stars. Is that going to ever happen?
I mean, I don't think so. But, you know, I said no before. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Have they already asked you this
question? No, I don't know that they, I mean, I don't know that they'd have me, but I didn't think they'd have me before, you know? I mean, like, I feel like at this point, it's like, you know, I don't know if they would want me after me sort of being like, all right, I'm good, you know? I don't know how anybody took it. I mean, I know that I've talked to Michelle and she's like, you know, I don't necessarily understand it, but I totally respect it. And, you know, and I said it to Rue on the runway and I just was like, I really hope you don't see this as any sort of sign of disrespect. Like, it was absolutely not meant that way, but I don't know how anybody took it. I hope they didn't, you know, but I guess there's a paranoid piece of me that wonders, you know.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm continuing to tour my solo show that I've been doing. Actually, this I started touring this before All Stars happened, but it's called Inferno a Go-Go. It's my one-woman retelling of Dante's Inferno.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's super fun. And I'm actually bringing it here to Australia in September, which I'm super duper excited about.
I'll be sitting in the front row.
Yay.
Have you got a message for the queer community around the world that is listening to this right now?
Oh, man. Listen to yourself. Don't get unfiltered thoughts confused with authenticity. Love each other and protect each other just because we've come so far and we feel this sense of safety doesn't mean it's going to stay there. The world is really crazy, so we have to take care of each other and make sure that our community continues to thrive, and that's on each individual.
Well, Ben de la Creme, you're an amazing man. Thank you for joining us on Word for
Thank
Word.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.